Welcome to the Institutional History Podcast, The Mad, Bad and Bizarre, Part 3. Your hosts for the day are Daniel Shepherd and Gemma Minter. I should fancy, however, that murder is always a mistake. One should never do anything that one cannot talk about after dinner. Oscar Wilde, The Portrait of Dorian Gray.
In today's podcast, we're looking at the next set of convicts, those from the invalid class, moved from the temporary invalid prison at Lewes. They had different crimes, convictions, and incredibly different lengths of sentences. But what binds them is that they were all somewhat vicious.
A bad sheriff. September 1842. George Mobbs, a respectable, quite educated farmer, had just received some money. Not a large amount, but enough to warrant a little treat for himself. Mobbs decided to do what any right-minded 19th century gent would do. He travelled the 3 miles from his farmhouse, Dean Hill, to Steeple Aston to attend an exciting astronomy lecture. He met with a friend, Mr. Goodman, and the pair watched, listened, and presumably learned all about the Victorian view of the cosmos. The talk itself is lost to history, but one hopes that it was a positive experience. The following few hours wouldn't be. After the closing remarks, they travelled on to a public house, The Fox, which you can still visit today, and wound down the Saturday evening with a few drinks and congenial conversation. At around 11 p.m, Mobbs, fortified with a beverage or two, headed home on his horse. There were no consequences then for drunk riding. That's the last time Goodman saw him.
He was found on a pile of stone the next morning, just off the route to his home. A local coroner named Dr. Turner performed an autopsy a few days later. He said,
"I found the upper part of his spine forced into a hole at the base of his skull. There was a laceration of the brain." It was further reported that he had fractures to bones around his eyes and collarbone. Aside from the physical injuries, the movements of Mobbs's last hours and the cause of such damage went undisclosed for nearly 4 years. Indeed, when the autopsy report came back, the description was "found dead." The assumption of death by misadventure was an easy one to make. A few drinks and a fall from a horse. The case rested until 1846. In Banbury, some 11 miles from Steeple Aston, a man named Jacob Skerry was arrested for the theft of livestock. It was definitely not his first conviction, and so he was looking at a very long prison sentence. He demanded to see a magistrate, claiming he had news of a murder. It's curious why he chose this time to reveal all. Perhaps guilt was consuming his soul, or, more likely, he had hoped for a lighter sentence.
The greatest likely driving force was to avert the ire of the judge and jury when prosecuting him for his many and brutal crimes.
Including attempting to stab a Mr. Timms, and to brain Mr. Morgan with a hammer back in 1844. A man with so many convictions and little hope of redemption would no doubt be fearing the hangman's noose.
But whatever the reason, Skerry made a full disclosure, and Mobbs' death was no longer considered accidental. Warrants for the arrest of the two men were released, and the newspapers went wild with stories of black deeds and dark nights.
That fateful evening, after leaving Mr. Goodman at the Fox, Mobbs made his way home, passing through the gate at the entrance to his farm, and travelling alongside some kilns. Here he espied 3 men preparing stolen eggs. The men were later identified as Isaac Sheriff, a tinker, James Biddle, and Jacob Skerry. The men ran, and Mobbs, imbued with Dutch courage, pursued them down into Dunstan Lane. There he was pulled from his horse, beaten over the head, and robbed. the men taking and sharing 5 shillings, but left his watch, which would have been missed and could be traced. Skerry claims to have been utterly appalled by the actions of his comrades, but threatened with death if he spoke out, he kept stum. Sheriff and Biddle, however, claimed that Skerry had struck the first blow. Biddle and Sheriff were both charged with willful murder and sentenced to death, but this was later commuted to transportation. For lucky Sheriff, at least, that meant life in English prisons, and even then, in the end, not a full life. He was released on license in 1863, having served 17 years. Sheriff's last 4 years of service were at Woking, as prisoner number 208, and he was the first lifer to enter Woking's hallowed gates. He died finally in 1874, 34 years after the murder of the innocent, amateur astronomer George Mobbs.
Prisoner number 219, the striking shoemaker.
Abraham Heath was a shoemaker who loved a double. An irredeemable drunk, and on his second wife, Elizabeth Heath. Here was a man for whom just one was never enough. Elizabeth was 40 years old, homely, ailing, and living in Exeter. She was known to the local workhouse as needing poor assistance and medical support, and money was always a struggle. Add to this a drunkard for a husband, and this would prove a recipe for murder.
Once again, he had drunk his earnings, and Elizabeth wasn't pleased. On the evening of the 7th of June, 1852, the pair fought.
At first, it was cutting words and damning slurs. Then Abraham, a decade her senior, took hold of a fire poker and smote her with it soundly. He rained blows down upon her upper body, and only stopped when, having struck her soundly around the head, she screamed, "Murder!" A neighbour, Dina Goss, witnessed him holding the poker, and watched the drunkard deliberately berate his wife while she held his sobbing daughter in her arms. Incensed and infuriated, Dina reprimanded him with strong words. A strange thing for a woman to do. And made it abundantly clear that it was shameful for him to carry on at his wife so. Heath left and returned to his second home, a local pub house called The Sun. Throughout the day, Elizabeth's concussion would have been increasing and her condition worsened.
Abraham returned frequently to continue their sporadic spat. A witness, Mrs. Dark, reported that an hour after the initial blows, Heath had stood by her, sworn, and stated,
"I'll be your butcher," to his wife. By 11 p.m, Elizabeth and her children were in the street, begging to be allowed to enter the house, as they had been barred from it by the crocked cobbler. Heath's response was to douse his wife in hot water from kettles and saucepans, and to leave her scalded, dripping in the street. The newspapers of the time reported that this vile conduct continued throughout the next couple of days, with Elizabeth during this time being struck with bellows, pokers, and at one point threatened with a knife.
She continued to decline. An abscess formed on her temple from the poker blows, and unbeknownst to all,
an effusion of water was forming on her brain. By Thursday, she was noticeably unwell, collapsing on the stairs, and Elizabeth herself did not think she would live through the night. The local beadle, a type of church official who dispensed aid and kept records, called Mr. Shears, visited Elizabeth to ascertain her health, and after seeing how poorly she was, and hearing her husband's threats, including, "I shouldn't mind going to the scaffold for her," had the man locked up by the local constabulary before sending for a nurse inmate from the workhouse. Elizabeth's children, with no local relatives to take them in, were also sent to the workhouse. This nurse, Eliza Frost, stayed with Mrs. Heath throughout the course of several days. Frost reported that her mental state deteriorated considerably, and that Elizabeth had begun wandering in her mind.
The doctor, whilst initially concerned by the abscess and resultant fever, had thought that she may recover, but by Sunday, 6 days after the beating, it was evident that Mrs. Elizabeth Heath was not long for the mortal realm.
On Monday, the 14th of June, 1852, Elizabeth Heath died. Abraham Heath was held in bond until the particulars could be ascertained. He had been repeatedly arrested for his treatment of his wife, and multiple assaults littered his record. His temper was also known to be cruel. He was not a jolly drunk, but a spiteful, scathing one. The threats made towards Elizabeth had been heard by many, and multiple neighbours were happy to speak up for the poor, deceased, good-natured woman. A coroner was called, and the case began in earnest.
Examinations of Elizabeth's body showed that the abscess descended in through the skull, and that a pea-sized section of her skull had been hewn away from the rest and was embedded in her brain. This caused serious trauma, internal hemorrhage, and eventually, after what must have been a painful 7 days, death.
During the court case, Heath attempted to wheedle his neighbours into speaking for defence, but their response was damning and documented a vicious, systematic, and brutal attack on a woman who had the misfortune to be his bride. The jury, considering all of this, returned a verdict of manslaughter, because, whilst he admitted in front of witnesses that he had caused her injuries, no one could ascertain if the fatal blow had been witnessed. He was thus sentenced to transportation for life. Abraham, following the normal pattern for prisoners at the time, was not transported, but shipped around to various prisons, and then, after his health began to decline in the 1860s, he was moved to Woking Prison. He petitioned for his own release, but none was forthcoming. Surprisingly, unlike so many other prisoners, he had a visitor during his time there. Perhaps he could command the affections of some. In the April of 1861, Abraham Heath died. Petitions ignored, liberty denied, a death no less ignominious than his wife's. He is likely buried with the rest of Woking's inmates in a pauper's grave at Brookwood Cemetery. But what of his children, Mary and Elizabeth, taken into the workhouse on his arrest? Indeed, the two very girls he kissed so lovingly during the trial for their mother's death. There is certainly a mention of one of his girls in a letter received during 1858 from an old employer. The man states, "Your daughter looks up very well. She has got a fine girl." This does indicate that at least one of the children was kept in the area for several years. It's likely to be the eldest, as the mortality rate for those below the age of 5 was significant, and there is a possibility that a child under 2 may have been privately adopted out. It's also possible that a record from 1861, a census, listing Mary Heath as a servant to a family of millers and labourers, is that same missing eldest daughter. If we find anything more, we'll be sure to keep you updated. From vile to zoophile, and the next prisoner in our list, number 220, George French.
George was a widowed labourer, aged 73 when he entered Woking Prison in 1860. By this point, he'd been in various other prisons for 24 years and would, unfortunately, only leave Woking 3 years later in a coffin.
His crime is not a pleasant one, but offers a certain light relief, which is apt. George French was convicted and sentenced to life for an unnatural act with a female ass. Note the gender of the ass, because, of course, it would be so much worse if it were a male one. Nor is he the only zoophile moved into the prison on the 22nd of March, 1860.
Just 6 prisoners later, Christopher Wilson, a farrier from Nottingham, was also convicted for relations with a female ass. No doubt the donkeys were quite annoyed by these men. We dare say they got the hump.
The last of our prisoners in this podcast is a somewhat darker affair. The attempted murder of Charlotte Carter, prisoner 230.
Charlotte Carter stood in the court at the Old Bailey. She was heavily scarred, the wounds on her neck and hands having only had 2 months to knit closed. The prisoner, her ex-common law husband, was Thomas Rowles, who was also scarred about the neck.
The court opened on the 9th of May, 1853. The prosecutors slowly led the judge through the events of that previous March.
"I am Charlotte Carter," she announced to the room. "A single lady. We don't know how much bravery it took for her to stand there in front of her attacker and declaim his guilt. Imagine for a moment what it took. Wounds still healing, a courtroom full of men. Imagine what it cost her. As we listen to her story, we hope that we can learn from such bravery." On the 28th of March, 1853, Charlotte, single for about a fortnight, went to a local house to buy some ribbon to decorate a cap. So started a normal day. But Thomas had something else in store and was there before her.
Thomas Rolls, aged 45, had been her common law husband for 4 years, and supposedly not all of those were happy. Charlotte had been the one to end their liaison, and she'd been living with another man since. When she entered the room, Thomas stood and asked her to accompany him to the kitchen to look at a letter from her uncle. She agreed and followed him.
After he handed her the missive, he asked, "Are you unhappy?" Charlotte, newly besotted, responded with a simple, "No."
"Well, I am," came the reply.
He wrapped his arms around her neck and attempted to slit her throat with a cutthroat razor. Charlotte screamed murder and fought him off, but was grievously wounded. The owner of the house ran in and chased Thomas off, who promptly ran into the garden whilst the police and surgeon were summoned. Descriptions of the damage she suffered were heinous. The Morning Chronicle reported the surgeon's words. On entering the apartment, the female was found weltering in her blood, her throat having been cut from centre-left ear, exposing the windpipe. The other wounds indicated the violent struggles she had made to save her life. The thumb of her left hand was nearly cut off, and the nail of the forefinger on her right hand was completely cut off. The ligatures of the thumb divided. Whilst the surgeon tended to her, police attempted to get to him. He had barred the door, but eventually, by sheer brute force, they broke through. What they saw was another scene of gore as Thomas had attempted to slit his own throat. The razor was wrested from his grasp, and the two were taken to the London hospital. For 2 weeks, it was unsure whether Charlotte would survive. But survive she did. And so she stood on that day and faced her ex-lover and brutal assailant, and when he asked, "Why did you leave me?" in front of the judge and jury, she responded clearly and evenly, and not without reason, "Through your ill usage."
The court returned a verdict of guilty. Both of the attempted murder and the attempted suicide, also a criminal offence. Mr. Baron Alderson recorded a judgment of death, stating that whilst the court would decide a fitting punishment in due course, he should expect to be removed from the country for a very long period. Eventually, he did spend time on hulks, but was soon returned to England, where in 1860, just 3 months after arriving at Woking Prison, he expired.
And Charlotte? Charlotte lived those years free. Despite the medical care we nowadays would think of as barbaric, she defied the odds and defied her ex-paramour. She lived. Thank you for listening to the Institutional History Society's third podcast. We couldn't have got this far without the London Archives, the British Library, and the Woking Lightbox. Special thanks to Kevin MacLeod for the use of his music in our podcast. Any comments, requests, or feedback, please send them through to our email, institutionalhistory@gmail.com. To find out more, sign up to our monthly newsletter on our website, institutionalhistory.com.